From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. President Biden is back at the White House after his first foreign trip, which included a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin, the G7 in England, and the NATO summit in Brussels. And the war in Afghanistan was a major topic. Biden repeated his pledge to end the war by September 11th, which is the 20th anniversary of the terrorist attacks.
Our troops are coming home. But we agreed that our diplomatic, economic, and humanitarian commitment to the Afghan people and our support for the Afghan National Defense and Security Forces will endure.
And that American withdrawal from Afghanistan is now underway. NPR's Tom Bowman told us just yesterday that all U.S. troops could be home by mid-July, which is well ahead of schedule. Let's bring in former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel for more. And Secretary Hagel, welcome back to the show. We actually haven't spoken to you since President Biden announced his plan to end the war. Is it a good idea?
I think it is a good idea. We've been there for 20 years. We've done a lot of good. But after 20 years, I think we've got to expect that the Afghan government is strong enough and independent enough to carry on without us. Now, we're going to continue to support them diplomatically, economically, in every way, but we're not going to continue to fight a war for them. And I don't think we should. There's no military resolution to this. I think it's going to have to be decided by the people, by the Afghan people. Diplomacy. Yes, the military is part of it, but this just can't continue to drag out. This is not 2001. This is 20 years later. There are different threats, certainly to the United States and the world, coming from all parts of the world. So I think the reevaluation that President Biden has put into this is correct, and I think his decision is correct.
Well, Secretary, you know, the big worry, though, is that this withdrawal will open the door wider to the Taliban. They have not lived up to the peace agreement terms that they signed with the Trump administration. Is this a concern for you?
Well, sure. There are risks in every decision a president makes. And you've got to decide where America is going to place its resources. What are its priorities? And as I said, after 20 years, it would seem to me, and I think the American people would expect this too, that when will the Afghan government be strong enough to defend itself? I don't know what's going to happen there. I suspect there'll be some compromise in how they form a government. I don't know. But there's risk in everything. And I don't think you can, as president, be paralyzed by risks and going through a what if scenario every day on every decision. Mm-hmm. You've got to make a decision.
I understand exactly what you're saying. It's been 20 years. But do you have confidence that the Afghan government can stop the Taliban at this stage from taking control of the whole country? They already control much of the rural areas.
Yes. Well, the Taliban are very strong. But let's evaluate that. Why are they strong? Well, obviously, a lot of people in Afghanistan are supporting them. Now, they have brutal tactics. They intimidate. But they couldn't be as strong as they currently are without the people of Afghanistan, or certainly a large portion of the people of Afghanistan supporting them. And if the people are against a government, I mean, I served in Vietnam. That's a good example of what can happen. The people turn against a government, and there's nothing that the United States can do. You can drop all kinds of bombs, spend 20 years and a lot of casualties on both sides. And we've taken a lot, thousands of dead Americans and wounded. And so, again, you've got to at some point come to a point as a leader in our national interests, make a decision. And it is uncertain, but I think the decision for the right reasons have been made.
I want to ask you about something else, Secretary. It seems clear, though, that the focus is now turning away from the Middle East and to China and Russia. Do these two countries now pose, in your view, the biggest national security threat to the U.S. and broadly? How does the administration counter that threat?
Well, yes, I think they do represent the biggest threats to this country, those two nations, as any nations out there today. The answer to the question that you just asked, how do you counter this? I think it's exactly what President Biden has done this week. You start with your friends, with your allies, with your partners, strengthening the alliances we have formed and built since World War II. You're much stronger as an alliance, as a group of nations, in dealing with adversaries, diplomatically, economically, militarily, intelligence. You're far, far stronger. And I think President Biden is wise in strengthening those alliances, especially before he met with President Putin. President Xi in China is watching this. And that's the first step. The second step is to be very clear, very direct, as President Biden and President Putin's conversation was, according to reports. You come at this from a position of strength, not weakness, but strength. As President Biden said, you lay down rules of the road. Now, that doesn't mean that the other countries are going to follow it. It doesn't mean that you necessarily trust the other countries. But I think you've got to clear the air. You have to engage. You have to be direct. And I think that's where President Biden is headed.
Former Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel. Secretary, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thanks, Sonia.
Well, how hot is it? In the western U.S., Phoenix is expecting its third day of 115+. In Lake County, California, it could reach 104 degrees. In Grand Junction, Colorado, a warning for temperatures up to 110. Hundreds of June records shattered as farmers, like California's John Taylor, despair about dairy cows.
If we don't have enough water and we don't have enough feed for these cows, the tough decisions are coming for all of us.
And here's Doug Nielsen of Nevada's Wildlife Department on that region's bighorn sheep.
We did see some mortalities on the mountains, and those mortalities were where they would normally find water, and there wasn't any.
Doctors in Arizona are worrying about third-degree burns from hot asphalt. And here's a mom in Utah.
So we have 5 kids. We're probably going to stay in the house, to be honest, and not go out.
But many people don't have air conditioning. States like Texas are warning those who do have AC, you may overburden power grids. That's NBC News that gathered some of that sound. Axios weather and climate reporter Andrew Friedman has been monitoring the effects. So, Andrew, this is another weather dome. Remind us, what is that?
You can think of it as a sprawling area of high pressure that essentially leads to a lot of sinking of the air over the western region. And as the air sinks, it warms up and dries out. It also blocks other weather systems from moving into the area. And those might be weather systems that would bring more moisture. So it's kind of redirecting the entire jet stream.
Right. It just stuck there. Well, there's also a government report out today from NASA and the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration finding that the Earth is warming faster than expected, trapping double the heat it did in 2005. Is there a connection? I mean, it's pretty unusual to have these temperatures in June.
It's very unusual to have these temperatures in June. There's a couple of aspects of this heat wave that are particularly suspicious for climate scientists. One is how expansive it is. And we're seeing extremely hot nights as well, which is also consistent with what we expect to happen due to climate change. Most scientists that I've talked with are telling me that it's pretty clear that climate change is ramping up the severity of this event. And there will be studies done on this particular event to try to figure out exactly what climate change's role is.
So there's the heat, and then there's the water. We heard that farmer talking about his dairy cows. And as the heat wave was starting a week ago, Utah's governor added this plea. Let's listen.
We need more rain, and we need it now. We need some divine intervention. That's why I'm asking Utahns of all faiths to join me in a weekend of prayer.
This is not unusual in Utah, which is a largely Mormon state. But where else are you having these water concerns?
The entirety of the West. Going from Colorado, once you cross the Continental Divide in Colorado, north and west of there, south and west of there, is mired in the worst drought that we have seen since at least 2000. And it's in the context of a larger, longer lasting drought that's the second worst in about 1,200 years. So what we're seeing is more and more desperation on the part of farmers. Lake Mead just hit its lowest level since it was constructed, and we expect that to trigger the first ever declaration of a water shortage on the Colorado River, and that'll change the water allocations given to several states. Hydroelectric dams are already producing lower amounts of electricity than they otherwise would. And the problem that we're seeing now is the drought and the heat is a self-reinforcing cycle. Once you get a hot air mass over there, more of the solar energy gets to go into heating the air rather than evaporating moisture from soils because there just isn't that much moisture there. So they have record dry moisture levels, which is bad news for wildfire season. And so they have dwindling reservoirs and rivers. Definitely a very serious drought and a very serious situation.
Well, very serious heat situation. You mentioned hydroelectric power being diminished. Well, that puts more pressure on the power grids, which we know are just getting overwhelmed, and so much to talk about. Andrew Friedman, Axios climate reporter, thank you so much for helping us take a look, and our best to listeners out west and in the southwest, just really tough right now. Thank you, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
The bill to make Juneteenth a holiday is now headed to President Biden's desk to become law. It's a day that commemorates the end of slavery across Confederate states in 1865. But this freedom for Black Americans did not translate into one of America's greatest freedoms, and that's the right to vote. That right would not fully become reality until 100 years later, in 1965, with the Voting Rights Act. And even then, many Black Americans were intimidated, arrested, fired from their jobs, beaten, and even killed for trying to exercise that right. Civil rights activist Fannie Lou Hamer relayed her harrowing experience at the Mississippi Democratic Convention in 1964.
It was the 31st of August in 1962 that 18 of us traveled 26 miles to the county courthouse in Indianola to try to register to become first-class citizens. We was met in Indianola by policemen, highway patrolmen, and they only allowed two of us in to take the literacy test at the time. After we had taken this test and started back to Roosevelt, we was held up by the city police and the state highway patrolmen and carried back to Indianola, where the bus driver was charged that day with driving a bus the wrong color.
57 years later, Insay Afoot, leader of the New Georgia Project, says while our access and ability to vote has improved, what we're experiencing today is a huge shift in voting rights, unlike anything we've seen since the 1960s. Afoot is responsible for leading the effort in Georgia that registered almost 500,000 people during the 2020 election. We caught up with each other to explore through her experience how voting and freedom are inextricably linked.
I would say that today's voter suppression is much more sophisticated than, you know, what I think often comes to mind when people are thinking about voter suppression, that what we are seeing across the country is tactics that appear race neutral on their face. So in my state of Georgia, you know, they have these voter purges that they do under a scheme called Exact Match. And so if a voter's information does not 100% match what is in the Social Security Administration's database, despite the fact that the Social Security Administration said, don't use our data that way, Georgia, the state of Georgia, the Secretary of State uses it to purge the voter rolls. So, you know, people with ethnic names, Black voters are 8 times more likely to be purged from the voter rolls. While it appears race neutral on its face, the impact that it has is just as bad as any Jim Crow era attempt to suppress votes that we've seen.
4 states have passed 22 laws that in various ways restrict the right to vote. And the overriding argument from Republicans in states like Georgia, Florida, and Texas is that these laws will make elections more secure, emboldened by the falsehood that there was widespread voter fraud during the 2020 election.
And the truth is that there's no evidence to support that anything that this current version of the Republican Party is introducing will make our elections safer or more secure.
Beyond these laws to restrict who can vote and how, many states, including Georgia, are using the 2020 census to redraw political maps, which can impact the political power in cities, towns, and neighborhoods.
The idea is that you can cut out an apartment building where there are working people and people of color because they're less likely to vote for, you know, a conservative candidate. Or you can, you know, take a university and like carve it out of your district because there are younger people there who might not be willing to vote for you. And so you can play with the lines of a congressional district, redistrict it in a way that basically guarantees that one particular party, the party that draws the map, stays in power, that they can pick and choose and gerrymander people in and out of their congressional district in order to create an electorate that is most favorable to the incumbent or whoever is in power.
And Afoot believes while the tactics that are being used to restrict this fundamental freedom don't look like the overt violence Americans like Fannie Lou Hamer experienced, the outcomes, deterring people from voting, are still the same. And that's part of the work she and hundreds of volunteers have undertaken over the last 2 years, registering people and also listening to them.
People will tell you what their hopes are, what their fears are, what their aspirations are for themselves, for their family, for their communities, right? And we work to connect the dots between the change that they told us they want to see, or the, you know, the things that they can't stand to see continue. And then we connect the act of voting into the change that they've told us that they want to see. So, for example, last summer when George Floyd was murdered and it sort of kicked off the summer of racial justice protests and the uprisings, you know, our canvassers and organizers organized me. At that time, we were not doing in-person events at all. They marched on the boss. They had a whole pitch that we don't want any daylight between us and the young people in the communities that we organize with. Can we please go register voters at this George Floyd protest? So I capitulated and they went out. And, you know, some of the feedback that we got was incredible, right? Like they're talking to a young person, 19, 18 years old, just newly eligible to register to vote. And they're like, well, why would I vote? This doesn't matter. They're killing us in the streets, et cetera. And the response from our organizer was, you've taken the time to put this sign in the middle of a pandemic. You've come out into downtown Atlanta to protest police violence. Don't you know that it's the mayor of Atlanta that appoints the police chief, that it's city council that sets the police budget, right? And so if you don't believe that hiring more cops actually makes our community safer, then you absolutely need to make sure that you are voting for mayor and city council in 2021.
Afoot sees the recent passage of Georgia's voting rights bill as a setback, but she revels in the fact that she and hundreds of volunteers were part of flipping a traditionally Republican stronghold blue during the presidential election. And in this increasingly partisan divide, she sees this as progress towards freedom and truly realizing the American dream.
There's a growing recognition that because we love ourselves, because we love our families, that we need to do everything that we can to make sure that A, we can protect them, but also B, that we can build the world that they deserve. And one of the tools that can be used to do that is your vote, right? Is the ability to hire people who will go to Washington, D.C. or go to Atlanta to do the people's work, to do work on behalf of your community.
That was Insay Afoot, CEO of the New Georgia Project.
In Hong Kong, police have arrested the editor-in-chief and four other top editors at one of the region's most outspoken newspapers. Police then raided the paper's offices and seized reporting materials, all using a sweeping national security law. It's an important story from NPR's Emily Fang, which is why we're bringing it to you again.
Editor-in-chief Ryan Law was led out of the Apple Daily offices in handcuffs. True to form, Apple Daily live-streamed the entire arrest. Meanwhile, officers were also arresting his four deputies at their homes across Hong Kong. Three of them are top-level editors at the feisty investigative tabloid.
Chen Pu Man and platform director of Apple Daily, they're our top three editorial people. They've just stripped out our top three editorial people.
This is Mark Simon, an executive with Next Media, the publisher that owns Apple Daily. He's outside of Hong Kong, and I called him as police were still searching the Apple Daily headquarters. The paper's billionaire publisher, Jimmy Lai, has already been imprisoned for organizing illegal protests. Lai and nine associates already faced national security charges, and Lai's company bank accounts and company shares all frozen. So why are police going one step further and arresting the paper's journalists?
Because we're not shutting down. Look, there is huge frustration that Apple Daily won't stop.
They're among the 120 or so arrests under the national security law as Beijing tightens its control over Hong Kong. The crimes alleged today by Hong Kong's national security police were that the editors had commissioned articles that allegedly called for international sanctions on China in response to the very law they've been arrested under. This live stream showed the police searching the paper's offices today. The arrests are just the latest blow to Apple Daily.
They announced that they've seized everything, and we said, well, that's okay. We've got enough cash for 18 months. What? 18 months? We can't have you around for 18 months. In other words, every single time they've come up with a plan to kill us, we've managed to survive.
So police today said they'd frozen more corporate assets and frozen the company's stock shares. Simon says Apple Daily will keep running.
This morning, our staff has told me, until the lights go out, we keep publishing.
But they have fewer and fewer staff left. Emily Fang, NPR News, Beijing.
On NPR's Rough Translation,
there's just fewer people that know somebody that's in the military.
After 20 years of war, are civilians and military farther apart than ever?
They were asking me, do you want to hear this? Do you want to know us?
Listen to Homefront, the new season of Rough Translation.
Unemployment claims are on the rise again. For the first time since late April, the number of people who filed for jobless benefits went up to more than 400,000 last week. It's the largest increase since March and comes as a number of states are eliminating extra pandemic unemployment relief early. Let's bring in MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent Ali Velshi. And Ali, this report is from the Labor Department. Can we assume several states ending their extra $300 weekly unemployment benefit early, the pandemic relief? Republicans say those programs discourage people from going back to work. Pandemic relief goes away, so people turn to unemployment. Is that part of what's happening here?
Well, it's hard to know because there are a lot of factors that go into this. So, you know, 1 week doesn't a trend make, but we expected about 360,000 new claims. We got 416,000. Almost all of the gains, for some reason, came from Pennsylvania and California. Now, just to put this in perspective, 400,000 this week. A year ago, it was 1.5 million per week. Mm-hmm. The continuing claims mean the number of people who continue to claim unemployment insurance right now, 3.6 million people. A year ago, it was 18 million. So the overall trend is lower, but we've seen a spike this week. We've seen a number of states, four of them, Alaska, Iowa, Mississippi, and Missouri, cut off that federal unemployment assistance last Saturday. So that's about 300,000 people. We wouldn't see that recorded in the numbers yet. This Saturday, we see another eight states doing that, but Pennsylvania and California aren't in those. So this may be a statistical anomaly. We're not quite sure what it is, but we are going to see all of that federal unemployment benefit, the extra up to $300 a week, end by the middle of July. So I would say that it may be another month or month and a half before we are able to sort of say what the effect of the end of those unemployment benefits will mean in terms of people looking for jobs.
Well, but we're also hearing that employers are struggling to find certain workers right now. How does that square with the high number?
Yeah, there are a number of industries in particular where it's just impossible to find workers. There's demand post-pandemic as things reopen for a lot of areas, including wait staff, restaurant workers, hotel workers, lumber mill workers, truck drivers, things like that. People who had sort of gone off of their jobs And now they're trying to get them back. And what's happening is a lot of companies are having to pay up for those workers to get them back. That's resulting in inflation. On the other hand, lots of people have an income that they didn't have a year ago. So they're buying more things, going out and spending at these restaurants and buying things. That's also contributing to inflation. So we've got a job squeeze at the moment. We've got an unemployment squeeze. We've got more jobs available than there are people. I will remind you, back in February of 2020, before the pandemic, as it was just getting started, we had a similar situation. We had a very low unemployment rate, and wages were going up. So again, we won't know where that balances out. The Fed chair had said just yesterday, in fact, that we're on the path to a very strong labor market, but this uncertainty that's been dwelling on people about schools and going back to work is still keeping some people home. Childcare continues to be a problem. People who go back to work are having trouble finding people to take care of their kids, so that's keeping some people off the working rolls as well.
Yeah, you mentioned the Fed. The Federal Reserve announced yesterday it was upping its projections because of inflation and will likely raise interest rates earlier than expected, apparently to calm down the buying we're seeing, you know, inflation tied to so many people buying things, demanding things, and creating a logjam in products. So that's going on as well. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you as always.
My pleasure.
Gay and transgender students will be protected from discrimination under Title IX. The Department of Education made that announcement Wednesday, rolling back restrictions imposed by the Trump administration. Let's bring in Kate Sawson, who reports on LGBTQ issues for the 19th. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. So Title IX says federally funded schools can't discriminate against students based on their sex. But the Trump administration didn't consider gender identity to be under the definition of sex. How does this announcement from the Department of Education reverse Trump-era policies?
This announcement will be watershed for transgender students, transgender non-binary students. Under the Trump administration, were legally told that they could not use bathrooms that they identified with in terms of gender, locker rooms, and then, of course, what we saw in a lot of states, couldn't do extracurricular activities like sports according to the gender that they identified with. This guidance now seems like it's going to head some of that off by saying that sex discrimination covers LGBTQ people, transgender people in particular. What we will likely see is a push to come up against some of those bills, including those trans sports bills.
You believe this wave of legislation will definitely be impacted by this announcement from the Department of Education. And just for the backstory on there, we're seeing legislation in places like Florida and Mississippi and Tennessee, as well as Arkansas, banning transgender student athletes from playing on teams.
You know, legal experts have said that they're not certain how this announcement will impact those bills. But what we saw in Idaho last year, which passed the first of these anti-trans sports bills, was that a judge halted one of those bills and did it on the basis of this Supreme Court ruling that this guidance is based on. And what it basically says is that when you have a law that protects people on the basis of sex discrimination, that includes LGBTQ people, right? And so I think that there has been a belief that a lot of these bills might not stand a legal challenge because of the Supreme Court decision, and this probably gives some life to that.
We have seen different administrations interpret Title IX differently. Do trans rights activists want to see a firmer federal legislation protecting the rights of transgender students in the form of a law?
Yes. You know, I think that talking to trans people, trans advocates, trans youth, their parents, and trans adults, there is widespread exhaustion over, you know, we can't go through this every time an administration changes and we see new executive orders. Transgender people have basic rights to use a bathroom, to participate in society, to join sports teams, to access healthcare, and that cannot be at the whims of whoever is elected. The Equality Act is stalled in the Senate, it's passed the House, and that would firm up a lot of those protections. And all of these piecemeal things that the Biden administration is doing, a lot of people appreciate those things, I think, are excited about those things, but they can be undone. And I think that there's a real hunger for lasting change.
Kate, before I let you go, I want to ask you about today's Supreme Court ruling, which was a unanimous ruling in favor of religious rights over LGBTQ rights. The court decided that Catholic Social Services, that's a private agency, was entitled to renew its contract with the city of Philadelphia for screening foster parents, even though the agency violated city law by refusing to consider a married LGBTQ couple as foster parents. Do advocates see this as a setback?
That's a really difficult question. A lot of LGBTQ experts have said that this is a very narrow ruling. At the same time, it is a ruling that says that there should be an exemption for agencies looking to turn away LGBTQ plus couples. And so, yes, I think a lot of LGBTQ plus advocates will see this as a setback and a dodge by the Supreme Court to undertake an issue wherein the basic dignities of LGBTQ plus people are affirmed.
Kate Sossin is an LGBTQ reporter for the 19th. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And staying with sports, lots of Olympic trials now ahead of the games in Tokyo next month, the swim trials in Omaha this week, the gymnastics team trials next week in St. Louis. And in Eugene, Oregon, races start tomorrow to pick the U.S. track and field team. A concentration of elite training groups has turned the Pacific Northwest into a factory of Olympians in distance running. The Northwest News Network's Tom Bonzi reports on why that is.
The track and field squad is the single biggest component of Team USA bound for the Tokyo Olympics next month.
Gentlemen, on your mark.
It's a safe bet based on recent results that a sizable portion of the U.S. Olympic running team will have ties to the Pacific Northwest.
Come back!
Strong showings at the recent Portland Track Festival gave a confidence boost to Olympic hopefuls who live in the Northwest. To be fair, many of the top American distance runners who train here aren't originally from here. Middle distance runner Vincent Ciotti moved clear across the country to join Nike Oregon Track Club Elite in Eugene, this when he turned pro after graduating from Virginia Tech in 2018.
Track Town USA is like a mecca for running. Like, I knew that OTC and being a Nike athlete came with, you know, great resources, like great physio, you know, good facilities to use. I knew that the new Hayward Field was being built, which was a big, big draw.
U.S. 1500-meter champion Craig Engels hails from North Carolina and competed in college for Ole Miss, but now calls Portland home. He trains with Coach Pete Julian's group based at the nearby Nike headquarters.
It's a tough adjustment if you come from somewhere else. Like, I came from Mississippi where it's sunny. And in the winter here, it's real rough, but now I love it.
Nike sponsors two separate pro running teams at its main Beaverton campus. The second one is called the Bowerman Track Club. They recruited middle distance standout Elise Cranny from Stanford.
Growing up, like since high school and watching them compete, it was something that I was like, I really want to be there. I feel like I'll get the most out of myself because of like the team atmosphere and everyone pushing one another. So I think I was really hoping that that would be an opportunity, and I feel so grateful to be here and be training with these women.
The background for how the Pacific Northwest became a magnet and finishing school for future Olympians involves several big personalities and, of course, the deep pockets of the sportswear companies headquartered around here. Foremost, that's Nike, but also Seattle-based Brooks and Wazelle, both of which sponsor their own pro teams. Track and field beat writer Ken Goh watched the rise of the elite training groups from his perch at the Oregonian newspaper, from which he recently retired.
This all started because Alberto Salazar was at Nike and was distressed to see no Americans who were medal contenders or threats at the international level in the distances. Mm-hmm. It had been pretty much taken over by East African runners.
Salazar was a top American marathoner who went on to found the Nike Oregon Project 20 years ago. The goal was to bring respectability back to American distance running. Salazar is no longer coaching because of anti-doping allegations lodged against him. Another name Ken Go credits is Vin Lanana, a former coach and athletic director at the University of Oregon. Lanana oversaw the establishment of the Oregon Track Club Elite Branch in 2006. Go says it's amazing to peek behind the curtain and see the resources the top training groups provide their chosen athletes.
Well, they've got everything. And they have underwater treadmills, they've got weight rooms, they've got physiologists, psychologists, weight coaches, you name, whatever they want, whatever they need, they have.
Brooks Beast Track Club head coach Danny Mackey says the pandemic took a lot of those resources away temporarily.
And every group was affected a little differently because the cities were, you know, had different lockdowns. And so Seattle was really restricted. And so there was a point where we talked about going to a state that was really open just to be able to have, like, the training needed.
With things mostly back to normal, the Pacific Northwest-based training groups are now not only stocking the shelves of Team USA, but more than half a dozen foreign countries, too. That's by virtue of letting in top runners from places like Canada, Europe, Japan, and Australia. For Here and Now, I'm Tom Bonsi.
The border to Canada has been closed to non-Canadians with few exceptions for 15 months. A colleague, a Canadian citizen, had to go into quarantine for 2 weeks when she traveled back and take tests, even though she's fully vaccinated. They're strict in Canada. But as vaccinations continue to bring down case counts in the U.S. and Canada, people on both sides of the border are calling for restrictions to be lifted. Brian Higgins is the Democratic congressman representing New York State's western border with Ontario. Representative Higgins, welcome back.
Thank you very much for having me.
And we last spoke in October. You were calling on then-President Trump to ease border travel restrictions. Now there's a new administration. There's a vaccine. Case numbers way down. We know President Biden has working groups going on this, but what's the holdup?
I don't know. You know, we've been in shutdown, both the United States and Canada, for 15 months, and we were told that the inflection point, the game-changing moment, would be the availability of vaccines. And it's astonishing the powerful medicine that this vaccine is. You have immunity if you're fully vaccinated. So people that have property from Buffalo over in Canada, going over to visit their cottages or their homes, they pose no risk to anybody. So yeah. It's incumbent upon the president and the prime minister to get the border open.
Well, a couple of things. You don't have full immunity when you've been vaccinated. It's successful, and you know, one of the vaccines is 95% of the time, I think. And some U.S. citizens just did come back into the U.S. and picked up the Delta variant, and they'd been fully vaccinated. So there's a small chance that you can be carrying or get sick with COVID-19. Canadian Prime Minister Trudeau had in the past pointed to Canadian case counts being far below the U.S., and that's how he justified the border closing. He didn't want Americans to come across and bring the virus with them. But that's no longer true. New York State and Ontario both have about 300 new cases a day, and more than 70% of adults in New York have been vaccinated. But can you understand his fear?
No,
Prime Minister Trudeau's fear. You can't at all.
No, I can't. No. If you look at, you know, again, both Canadian and U.S. residents, citizens have been told for 15 months that to follow the science, to follow the data, to follow the facts. And if you look on the website today from the United States Center for Disease Control and Prevention, it says if you are fully vaccinated, the power of these vaccines, even against the variants, you no longer have to wear a mask. You no longer have to socially distance. You know, because you're fully vaccinated. That just underscores the power of this vaccine. So whether it's 10% of the Canadian population or 45% of the American population that's fully vaccinated, they should be able to travel. And I think it's incumbent upon both leaders to do it safely and successfully, but to do it, you know, make a move. People need to know that everything that they've done over the past 15 months, now there are vaccines, and that is a game changer, and it needs to be recognized as such. Because we have been told, again, to follow the science, follow the facts, follow the data.
We know, as you mentioned, that there are people who want to get to their cottages. To them, this is an extension of, you know, this their backyard. And that is tough. But what are some of the other things that a border closing is impacting? Freight, shipping. How is it impacting things like the economy?
Well, the economies of both Western New York and Southern Ontario are adversely impacted. That's true. But it's also generally the life quality and the fact that loved ones have been separated for 15 months. That's an emotional issue. That is a mental health issue. And there are ways to do this safely and successfully. Now, this nonsense about having to quarantine still is totally irrelevant to anybody's public health. If you have been fully vaccinated, you know, you have immunity and pose a very low risk of giving or getting COVID.
Well, by the way, we should say that Trudeau is walking his talk. He apparently abides by the quarantine, but there are exceptions for hockey players, apparently.
That's the point. Yeah. So they make an exception for the National Hockey League. Look, I love hockey. I played hockey, and I played up in Canada. But the fact of the matter is, what's driving that? It's the National Hockey League playoff schedule. That's not the science. So if those players are fully vaccinated and they're able to cross the border, why aren't people who've been separated from their loved ones for 15 months? It sounds very arbitrary to me, and it sounds political. You've got a battle going on in Ontario between the conservative Ontario premier and the liberal federal government under Justin Trudeau. So, you know, let's put all of these issues aside. Let's follow the science, follow the facts. And I think we can come to a safe conclusion that the United States-Canadian border needs to be open, at least incrementally, initially, and then a more comprehensive opening further into the summer season.
That's Congressman Brian Higgins, the Democrat who represents the beautiful area of Buffalo and Niagara Falls, New York. Congressman, thank you.
Thank you, Robin. Thank you for having me again.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.